At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
We seem to expect people to be able to do everything. They have to be great politicians and or sports stars, and they have to
write a book.
I'm just going to write a book. Sure, I can write a book. Absolutely, I could write a book. And, you know, it was great because I just did it.
Yeah.
I didn't. And I learned by doing.
This is a confessional. True life, some chefs don't show up for their own cookbooks.
The hardest part of any cookbook is the proposal.
Hi, and welcome to Burnt Toast from Food52.com, a podcast about what we all talk about around the stove, at the water cooler, in the office. It's what doesn't make it on the website, but what we're all talking about otherwise. I'm Kenzie Wilbur, the slightly hoarse managing editor of Food52, and I'm here with our co-founder Meryl Stubbs. Hi, Meryl.
Hi, Kenzie.
And our guest today is New York Times writer and prolific cookbook author Melissa Clark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And today we want to talk about cookbooks, but specifically what it means to co-author or ghostwrite, which I think is a good place to start because to me, the term ghostwriting sort of feels like it has a negative connotation.
Well, I mean, it depends. I think ghostwriting is more specifically for people who are writing memoirs, important political figures or sports figures or just important people in the world who want to make it seem as if they had written their own book. We seem to expect people to be able to do everything. They have to be great politicians and or sports stars, and they have to write, which is actually ridiculous. So they're hiding the fact that they needed a collaborator. I don't do that. What I do is co-author. And so what that means is that my name is visible on the cover of the book. Everybody who opens the book knows that whatever culinary personality I'm writing with is we partner together and we work together on the books.
Yeah. Well, I feel like probably I would expect that when people ask you to write a book on their behalf or to co-author, your name is lending credibility.
Now it is,
yeah,
yes. But not when I started, but certainly now.
Yeah.
Now, you know, just to put it out there, I actually do not co-author any more books. It's something I'm not allowed to do being on staff at the New York Times. So my co-authoring days are over for now, at least. And
too bad, any of you who were hoping.
And, you know, I mean, I love doing it. I mean, I learned so much from it. You know, I worked with amazing people. I've worked with David Boulay. I work with Danielle Boulud. I work with the guys from Blue Ribbon Restaurants. I worked with Bill Yassas, who used to be the pastry chef at the White House. And every time I did a book, it was like having these people as my private tutors, and they were teaching me how to cook better.
Did anything ever surprise you?
Oh, constantly. I mean, well, the most surprising thing was having worked with all these extremely accomplished chefs and realizing that all of them did it differently. Whatever it was. Was it a roasting a chicken or slicing an onion or, you know, putting a pot of beans on to boil? You know, one of the things that shocked me was when I worked with Andrew Feinberg from Franny's in Brooklyn, and he salts his beans right at the beginning. He salts his chickpeas, brines them, then cooks them. And I had always been told, oh, you can't do that. And so I started doing that. And you know what? Beans taste better when you salt them from the beginning,
uh-huh.
And they cook up just fine. It's funny. It's
like,
where did that myth?
Too. I don't know.
I don't know where that myth came from. But I mean, even aside from, you know, the specific things that I learned, just learning that everybody does it differently gave me license to do it my own way.
And you also probably had just this font of knowledge and technique that you could just pick and choose from, right?
Like, yeah.
Because
oh, yeah.
You'd have different ways of doing the same thing from different chefs, and then you could pick your favorite.
Exactly. So when I cut my onions, like, can we get nitty gritty here?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
We like really nitty gritty.
Okay,
please.
So you peel an onion, right? And then you slice it. Do you slice it around the equator, or do you slice it root to stem, right? So that's mm-hmm. one decision, and there are different reasons. It depends on how you're going to chop it, if it's going to hold
together. Choose your own adventure onion cutter.
Kind of, exactly. And then if you do it that way. And then I always whenever I, it's hard to describe, but whenever I would always cut onions into half moons in a particular way, and I would cut it across the equator so I'd get these half moons. It looked like a rainbow. Can you picture it in your head?
Yeah.
Look like,
right.
But Andrew Feinberg cuts
it the other way.
He does it the other way. And it turns out that they cook differently when you do them that way. They will maintain their structure a little bit more, because what I'm doing is I'm cutting across
the grain, basically.
And so I'm exposing more of the I'm basically making more holes in it,
right?
And so it cooks faster, but it'll lose texture more quickly. So what he does is he cuts it the other way, because he wants some of that texture, but you still get the browning.
Yep.
Fascinating, like these little itty bitty details.
I'm also learning that Andrew Feinberg is a little bit of a rogue cook.
He's a total rogue cook.
I love that.
Yes.
I love the idea that writing books with other people sort of informed the way that you probably wrote your own books. Your first book was actually The Bread Machine Cookbook, is that right?
Yes, it was.
Back in 1993.
Uh-huh. Yeah, tell us about how that came about, how you decided that was really the subject that you wanted to...
Do you really think I sat around and thought about, like, I'm going to pitch a bread machine? No, it was one of those things that someone said, hey, you want to write a bread machine cookbook? And I was in grad school, so I was too young to think about it too much. I was like, oh, money? You're going to pay me money?
Just write a book.
I'm just going to write a book. Sure, I can write a book. Absolutely, I could write a book. And, you know, it was great because I just did it.
Yeah.
I didn't. And I learned by doing.
You got your feet wet.
I got my feet wet. I had four bread machines going at the same time. I had to do this bread machine cookbook in 6 weeks. And it was over summer.
Had you ever used a bread machine before?
Oh, God, no. No.
You were like, I don't not want to write a bread machine cookbook, so I guess I'll write a bread machine cookbook.
Exactly. And it was just, wow, you're going to pay me money. And I think I probably spent all the money they paid me on ingredients anyway. I mean, I got very, very little, but it was so exciting and I had the best time. And I also learned another valuable lesson. Or, I mean, this is a lesson that I think all of us who cook keep learning over and over again. People like you when you come to their, you live in their building and you give them hot bread.
Oh, amen.
Seriously.
Like, here.
Most popular neighbor award.
Exactly. Yeah. Even if it was the infamous tuna casserole bread, even that one went over.
Oh, man.
Whoa, please describe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you put a can of tuna in the bread machine with, yes, you do, and some sour cream. And
do you like wrap it up inside the dough?
No. You have to throw it all in.
No, right, because you're just throwing in the ingredients anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the bread tastes vaguely tuna-like.
I think we need to run that.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I actually did not make it into the book. I don't even remember. But it was great. It's great for a tuna fish sandwich. You should, like, double tuna.
Double tuna.
Double the tuna.
Double the fun.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
That's hilarious.
I want to know if you had a mentor jumped in with this tuna bread and you just figured it all out by yourself.
Oh my God, no mentor would take me with a tuna bread. No, I had so many mentors. I'm very grateful. There are a lot of people in my life who, you know, supported me along the way. Very early on, I worked at a magazine called Great American Home Cooking, and I worked there for 2 years, and it never actually published. It was a magazine that was just, they kept retesting the issues. And so we had 6 issues, and we'd put out 6 issues, and we were testing them in the market. And it was a staff of people who used to be at Food and Wine magazine. And so these are great, talented, brilliant women and they're all women, as is often in the food world. And they really taught me. They taught me how to edit recipes. They taught me how to write a head note. They taught me how to test a recipe. I mean, just the nitty gritty of everything I needed to know for my career. This was right after I'd written the Bread Machine Cookbook. So, you know, I had my food cred because I had this publication. And I was also just out of grad school, you know, with my newly minted MFA. And I learned so much. Tracy Seaman, Pamela Mitchell, they just held my hand and taught me what to do. So that was the beginning. And then, you know, every job I continue to learn.
I want to get back to the co-authoring a little bit and talk about the process of actually creating a book with somebody else. I know a bunch of people who have worked on books with chefs and other authors, and they've described the process a little bit like dating. And I want to know how you think of it.
Oh, each book is so individual. It really depends. I mean, sometimes it's a romance. You know, you get swept up with this other person and their whole life's view. And, you know, you're like, should I leave my husband and fly off with whoever, you know, but Claudia Fleming and I are going to go, you know.
Make a happy home together.
Right, go. And then I loved working with Claudia so much. And then sometimes, you know, it's a little bit stressful. You have issues that come up, and sometimes it's a surprise. You think, am I going to be able to work with this person? And then you learn that, wow, you know what? They have a lot to say that I really didn't think think about. So each relationship is very different. I have to say the person who I worked with who surprised me the most, and I'm going to just talk about her because my name's all over her books, Paula Deen. I did her books, and I have never met anyone who worked as hard as she did. I mean, I was really surprised. I didn't know what to think. I had no idea. And this was, you know, years before all of this, the latest scandals. But she just worked her butt off. I would fly to meet her in her home in Savannah. And from the second I walked off the plane, you know, but in a respectful way. She was so respectful and so hardworking. So that was, you know, my experience. And again, it was very limited experience only with writing a cookbook. But I was very surprised because sure. I didn't know what she knew. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's not like she knew about other kinds of cooking, but the stuff she knew, she really knew, and it was solid. Mm-hmm. And she was also very curious. Mm-hmm. I introduced her to the arugula in her garden. That was thrilling.
That's amazing.
Surprise,
I love that
arugula.
Story.
I know, surprise. Well, you know, her gardener had planted all these things, and she didn't know. And I was like, oh, that's arugula. Let's make a salad. She's like, what?
I was actually going to ask. And you also worked on books with her sons.
Yes, I did.
And were they equally as surprising and curious in the kitchen?
No, different. You know, they had, they were a lot more cosmopolitan. You know, Paula really grew up in a, you know, very, I mean, as she'd say to me, not bad for a girl with, you know, from a trailer park. And she mm-hmm. really, you know, had a limited experience in just the whole world. And, but they were a lot more cosmopolitan, a lot more, you know,
exposed.
Knowledgeable in other cuisines. Mm-hmm. So very different experience.
Paula surprised you in her sort of demeanor and her knowledge. Did anyone who had asked for your help because they felt that they weren't capable or weren't interested in writing their own book, was there anyone who you sort of would have mentored into writing themselves like later on?
That's interesting. Probably Claudia could have written her own book if she had the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's less... You know, I think it's more time. I mean, mm-hmm. they just don't have the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can write really fast. Like, how many head notes can I write in an hour?
Right.
How many head notes can you write in an hour? Right?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
And for them, they would labor over one or two.
Right.
And so it's a different scale. And they have, you know, they have restaurants to run. So I think it was less, you know.
Yeah, I guess I assumed maybe different reasons, but that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it's really just about resources.
Exactly. And I can sit down at my desk all day long. I'm just fine.
We're pros.
Exactly. As long as we have enough coffee.
Exactly. I'm very happy sitting on my butt. So
no, but that's a good bridge into the recipes that chefs don't necessarily want to be sitting around in front of a computer all day. Mm-hmm. And so a co-author is a great person to have around to transcribe all those recipes that they probably just cook from the hip.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a very typical experience that you'll just watch? Take us through what it was like to, you know, watch Balud in the kitchen and try and transcribe a recipe
from
him.
Oh, well, that was impossible because, you know, Balud doesn't, he's not like he's hands-on cooking. You know, I mean, he would sometimes, but he has his whole team. So I would have to go to different people on the team to see different parts of the dish.
Mm.
And
oh, wow.
Yeah, so because, and he was, he's a big micromanager, which is great for quality. But, you know, so I basically work with two of his chefs who were sort of assigned to me to keep me out of trouble, basically. And so they would help me. And he was very involved in the recipe, you know, and these were the recipes he wanted to present. So we'd discuss them in detail, and then I would cook them with these two chefs, or sometimes they'd, you know, send me to someone else. And then I would cook them again, and then we would all taste them. And it was really this very laborious, process. But it was great. Whereas Waldy Malouf, I did his cookbook, he and I would sit down over coffee, and he'd say, okay, so you take four tomatoes, and then six cloves of garlic, and about a half a cup of thyme. And, you know, and he would just kind of, and then I would go home and test it. And, it was 90% perfect, the mm-hmm. recipe. He's like, he really could just visualize it. He's like, you take your leg of lamb, you butterfly it, then you take your garlic. I mean, and that was amazing, mm-hmm. too.
In a book like Balud's or Boulet's, where you are learning these recipes through teams of different people and their intricate dishes sometimes, how much are you thinking about, can a home cook pull this off in their own kitchen?
Constantly. Constantly. I mean, that's what that is my job. That
yeah.
my job is to be the chef whisperer, and my job is to say, can I do it like this? You know, they'll show me the elaborate way, and I'll say, can I simplify like this? Can I simplify like that? Why are you? And that's also reasons for the why, because
yeah. mm-hmm.
if it's not essential, I want to not use 17 pots. I would like to try to do it in two, you know,
right.
So I'm always thinking of that.
But I wanted to ask about industry standards for percentages of advances. When you're co-authoring a book, it's obviously different financially.
Mm-hmm.
And having done both, does that you know, does that change per book, per deal? Is there sort of a standard?
No, every deal is different. Sometimes you get paid a percentage of the chef's advance. Sometimes you get a flat fee. It depends on if you're testing recipes. It's so complicated. Oh my God. That is why I have an agent who just like gets me the best deal that she can, and I don't.
So you just don't even get involved?
I try. Well, or I mean, I have a minimum. I'm like, I'm not going to.
You don't do this anymore, but.
Yeah, in the past, right. No, yeah. I had a minimum, and it's like if they could meet my minimum. I mean, and I also, you know, every co-author does different parts of the book. Some co-authors only test recipes. Right. Some only do the writing. I do both, and I insist on doing both. I don't do a book unless I can test the recipes, because what if they're not good, and how am I going to write
them
if I don't?
You can't write about them if you haven't made them.
Right, but yeah. They're different. I mean, but then some chefs want their own people to test the recipes, and they just want the writer to write the head notes and the stories, and that's fine, too. I mean, everybody has their own way of working. It's not, one is not better than the other. But for me, what I want to do is I want to learn that chef's techniques. I want to get into their head. And I want to understand what they do. And because otherwise, it's a good job, but it's not a learning experience as much for me.
Mm-hmm. How easy or difficult is it to kind of put yourself into their shoes?
That is the most important part, at least of the voice. I mean, the recipes are another thing, but to get their voice, you have to get into their head. You have to anticipate what they're going to say. And it's really fun. I mean, for me, I thought it was great because I am also a frustrated fiction writer as well. So I love to, I mean, I love to write stories and I love to create characters. And so, you know,
it's like method acting.
Yeah, it is. It's great. You just get into their heads. Like, what would they say? And sometimes for some chefs who maybe don't show up to appointments and who maybe don't actually talk to you for the whole entire book, you just make it up.
This is who you should be.
Exactly.
This is your best you.
Exactly.
This is a confessional. True life. Some chefs don't show up for their own cookbooks.
Well, you know.
Are there like a couple of pre-cookbook like hangout sessions, like let's basically like dating.
Yeah,
like,
that for sure.
Let's get to know each other.
Yeah,
what are those like?
You usually go have a meal somewhere.
Yeah, you go have a meal at their restaurant, and then they try to impress you, and they send out all the dishes, and it's fun.
And
I mean,
you're
that's
kind of
great.
Ill by the end. Probably.
Well, you know, that is just an occupational hazard that you just have to, right? I mean, don't you know, I'm sure you guys have had endless tasting menus where you're just like, it's 2 a.m.
Have you
really
been driven to
home.
Tears? I have.
Yes, I cried. Yeah. I cried a per se. It was literally 2 a.m. And I said to them, I said, I really just want to go home. They said, only 5 more dessert courses.
No, they didn't.
They did. The waiter did. He's like, the chef has 5 more, totally embarrassed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, I mean, but that's, I mean, that's, it's still, it's an honor and a treat to be able to have those kinds of work complaints. You know, it's like, oh, I'm so, you know, exactly. So I'm pretty darn lucky. And, you know, if that's the biggest thing.
Was there a voice that you found it particularly hard to get into, or a chef or a writer who you found particularly hard to emulate?
I think the biggest challenge probably were the Brombergs, who are the most lovely people, but they're also both pretty good writers, and their writing styles are very different. And so my job was to sort of integrate them and integrate their voices into sort of this unified. It was very hard.
That's
because
hard.
And then I thought, well, can we do like different fonts with different voices, Eric says and Bruce says, but that got too complicated. So that was really hard to figure out how to create a voice of two people into one. And this happens a lot. I mean, you see a lot of, so it was this synthetic experience, like, okay, I'm going to just make this happen. And it was challenging.
What are some of the questions that you ask, that you have asked people that you've worked with, like to get to that, like, what do they want? Do you ask them what other cookbooks they like?
There's like a whole process, you know, what other cookbooks they like. Often they'll come to me and they say, I want to do a book, but they don't know what that book is. Uh-huh. So we spend a long time figuring out what the book is. The hardest part of any cookbook is the proposal. Absolutely. It is, for me, it's the roadmap for the book. I need a solid proposal. Uh-huh. Plus, the better your proposal, frankly, the more money you're going to get. So it's very important to work really hard right at the beginning.
And it's your pitch deck.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not something that you can throw together. It's something that I take a lot of time on. My proposals tend to be very in-depth and very long. And I mean, it's really, it helps me too, because I also, you know, when you're getting into bed with these people, you want to make sure that you all have the same vision from the beginning and that you all know what you're going to get at the end. And then, by the way, it all changes 100%. So, but at least you think you do.
Yeah.
You think you know.
Yeah.
Postscript, it will be completely different.
It will be completely different. In fact, you will end only 5 of the recipes that you start with will remain the same.
So you want to get somebody the book that they want. You want it to be cookable, which is a great, I mean, we think about that all the time. That's our business. That's what we do. But are there any other big sort of marquee things that make a cookbook great to you that you really strive for when you're writing something?
Yeah, I mean, I want to learn. I need to be learning. I'm not that interested in seeing the same recipes over and over again. And if they are the same recipes, there needs to be at least some teaching moments in the recipe so I'm understanding. Because otherwise, I'm going to be bored.
Have you been involved with the photography ever?
Yes. Not so much as a co-author. I try to stay out of that.
Okay.
Because chefs tend to be they're very specific about the way their dishes look. So I try to stay out of that.
So just for your own books?
Just for my own books, yeah. What I do help them do is try to help them figure out which are the dishes that I think make the most sense to photograph. Mm. Because sometimes, again, they'll want that rabbit stuffed with sweetbreads wrapped in foie gras. Mm. And so, you know, that is a beautiful dish. But I think I think the macaroni and cheese is really, that is the one that is, you know.
That's the crab leader.
That's going to be the one.
People are going to run away screaming.
or like the hot crab dip, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gooey with the crackers.
Oh, yeah. Do you lean one way or the other in terms of liking writing for yourself more, liking writing on a team?
Oh, they're just completely different experiences, and I love them both. I mean, I love learning, so, you need to have someone to teach you. So the chefs are great for that.
It seems like that's what makes them the same to you. You're learning on either process. It's obviously there are so many different things about working with someone else versus writing for yourself, but it seems like that's the thread that's the same.
Yeah, well, that's true. And, you know, even I'm writing a cookbook right now. It's all about dinner. And, you know, I've made dinner so many times. I mean, you'd think, but it's fascinating. I'm constantly learning. I'm enjoying it so much. We're eating really well.
Dinner is hard.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it's like, so what kind of book do you want to have to guide you through dinner? You know, and who are you? What kind of cook are you? Who am I writing for? Who's my audience? Is this a basic book? Is this a 2.0 book? Mm-hmm. Are these people who read Ottolenghi? Are these people who have never opened up The Joy of Cooking? You know, it's like figuring that out and then sticking to that is... It's a challenge. In my Times column, I can do whatever I want. I mean, obviously, whatever the editorial team and I come up with. But I don't have to be consistent. And this is 250 recipes of being consistent and having one point of view and one voice. And
Writing to a group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One group. You have a target. And
yeah. Well, I mean, it keeps shifting. So I have to kind of like nail it down at this point. But it's been – so that's a learning process too.
So what is there an angle yet for dinner? I mean, is it weeknight dinner?
It's – okay. So this is what it is. It's not entertaining. It's just weeknight dinners, so no legs of lamb, because you're not going to do a leg of lamb on a weeknight, even though leg of lamb is super easy and you throw the stuff on it, but it costs $97, so you're just not going to do it. But there's a lot of chicken, because you know what? Really, it's like out of 250 recipes, I think 38 of them are chicken. I think it's more of a 2.0 book than a basic book. I think it's for people who are comfortable with a preserved lemon. You know, they know where to get one in the grocery store.
I like that as an identifying marker of your culinary skill. Mm-hmm. Do you know what to do with a preserved lemon?
Exactly.
Are you comfortable with a preserved lemon?
Because there is something. It's like you have to take it out of the jar and then what? Do you take the seeds out? What about you use the whole thing?
Yeah.
What do you do? You know, and I will tell people what to do, but they just have to be comfortable with the whole, you know, maybe the mystery of it, and they'll read the recipe and they'll be like, all right, cool. So the preserved lemon, and then we put it with it. Hey, there's only 6 ingredients in this whole dish. And it's really complex because I use this preserved lemon. Wow. It's like salt, pepper, chicken, preserved lemon, and cilantro, and mint, and olive oil. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing I'm going for, is I want to do flavor combinations that are a little bit unexpected. Super easy technique, though. Mm-hmm. So because people don't want to have to, like, you know, suit in one pot or pan or maybe two, but, you know, very streamlined, small pieces of proteins, inexpensive, but, you know, exciting in terms of flavor.
So, Melissa, you have to go.
I do. I'm having 7 people over for dinner tonight, so I have to go home and cook dinner.
So it's 4:30 p.m. What time are they coming over?
They're coming at 7. I'm going to jump on the subway. I'll get home by 5:15 or 5:30 if I'm lucky. I have an hour and a half. I have my husband as my slave for that hour and a half. The chickens are marinating. I'm making chicken. I got up this morning, and I made this fabulous parsley jalapeno kind of salsa verde with anchovies and capers.
Yeah.
So I have that made. So I've got the chicken. I've got the chicken in the fridge. I've got this sauce. I have cute little micro potatoes and then whatever else I can find.
And a bunch of wine.
Great.
And a bunch of wine. Wine's in the fridge.
All right. Well, we'll let you go rescue your chickens. Thank you so much for joining
us. This was so much fun. Thank you.
Oh, we had a great time.
So that's it for this episode of Burnt Toast. Our producer is Tim Einenkel. Thanks also to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. Please let us know what you think of the show. Our Twitter address is @food52, and you can email us at editors@food52.com. If you like the show, tell everyone you know and subscribe to us on iTunes. Next time, we'll be answering your questions about throwing dinner parties, and we want to hear yours. Email us, tweet at us, or even better, record a voice memo on your smartphone and send it our way for a chance to be featured on the episode. For Melissa Clark and Meryl Stubbs, I'm Kenzie Wilbur. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.